Hi, HR Nation, it's Chris Rainey. Welcome to HR Leaders Live, the show where we interview today's most successful and innovative HR practitioners 5 days a week. Today, we're joined by Britt Andriata. Britt is an author on several books on the brain science of success. She's a CEO and president of Britt Andriata Training Solutions and a former chief learning officer at lynda.com. There's a lot there. Great. You've done a lot.
I know. I feel tired just listening to it.
That's a big challenge for me. Look, Britt, for those of our listeners that aren't aware of your amazing work, honestly, I've been following you for a long time now. Please give our listeners a little bit more of your background and your journey to where we are today.
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on, Chris. I'm a huge fan of your show, and I'm super excited to talk to the HR audience because this is my tribe, and I love working with my tribe and helping us all do better to bring out the best in our organizations. And I would say that that's kind of the core of my career. I've always been about helping people rise to their potential and organizations rise to their potential. And those things are linked, right? They have to go hand in hand for us to get the best out of everything. A bit about my background, as you mentioned, I was the chief learning officer at lynda.com, which is now LinkedIn Learning. And in that role, I was responsible for really the up-leveling of all the skills across our organization, from new hires to senior executives, managers, everything in between. And in addition, you know, I was recording content for the library. So I also was writing and recording courses. I have 10 of them out now. Three or four of them are on kind of talent development, and then there's several on leadership development. And I really believe in the intersection of those two things. I think the best leaders are also big learners, mm-hmm. and learning is the only way we can become the best leaders. So to me, those things are inevitably linked. And one of the things that happened to me was I was already doing learning and development, and I started to hear more and more about brain science. And since I have a PhD in education, leadership, and organizations, I thought, well, I'll just dust off my research skills and dig back into the journals and find out what neuroscience is telling us about learning. And I did that just to kind of up-level my own craft. And what I discovered was pretty astounding. I couldn't believe how much there was about how the brain actually learns and builds memories, and really specifically how we turn that into behavior change. And so I started sharing that with my peers, and then people were like, you need to write a book. So I did. My first one was called Wired to Grow, and it's on the brain science of learning. And that was really valuable, and it really changed how I approach learning. And it's now kind of the work that I do in the industry is really helping organizations maximize their talent by really making sure that they're delivering learning experiences that create the outcomes that they want. And then our company was acquired by LinkedIn, and I was in the middle of a massive change, and wow. I realized that everything I was teaching other people on change management was wrong, and it wasn't working. So since I had just finished kind of exploring the neuroscience of learning, I thought, well, let's see what brain science tells us about change. And so I dug back deep into the research and discovered some mind-blowing things about that, and that became book number two, Wired to Resist, and I think we're going to talk a little bit more about that today. Mm-hmm. And then my last book just came out on teams. And again, I found some really fascinating things from science. So all the work that I do is science-based, but what I really do is I synthesize research that's happening across several disciplines, making sure that I'm sourcing legitimate sources and really valid studies. But then I sync it up with the studies that we see every day, right? I mean, HR practitioners and those of us in the talent field, you know, we're all doing studies, all the big names in the space are doing studies. So I'm looking for the intersections between what do we see happening in real workplaces around the globe today, across industries, and how does that align with what we're hearing out of neuroscientists? And that's my sweet spot. So I really try to solve those problems. And I love what I do. I love what I do. And I love the people I get to work with.
I can tell. I've been following you for some time now. A bit of LinkedIn stalking, so I must admit that.
New friend.
How did you, just going back for a second to lynda.com, how did it get to the point where you started your own courses on lynda.com? Was that something that when you got the role as chief learning officer that was, you know, expected in a way? Or was it something that you was like, whoa, this is a perfect opportunity for me to share and help others out there? Just I'm very fascinated by that.
Well, it's a great question. So it was a surprise. So I came in, and lynda.com as a company at that point was about 300 people. They'd been in existence already about 10 years. Very established, but they had started first in the creative space. So courses for graphic designers and photographers, and they were slowly expanding, and they'd gone into business through software, like how to use PowerPoint and Excel and that kind of stuff. But they were really just starting to approach the, you know, management leadership. So I arrive on the job, and my goal is to provide learning and development to the employees. And I looked in the library, and there wasn't anything I could use because it wasn't there yet. So I proposed to Lynda Weinman, the actual woman, the co-founder with her husband, that I would start rolling out in-person training. And she was like, no, I want to use our product. And I said, well, there's nothing in the product right now that I can use. And she said, then record it.
Really?
So I spent my whole first year, which was really hard actually, because as an L&D person, I wanted to be out with people. And I spent 12 months in a 5 by 5 foot studio looking at a piece of glass, you know, trying to act like I was having an engaging conversation with real people when I was looking at technology. But we recorded all of my major content: leading with emotional intelligence, leading change, management fundamentals, all of the having difficult conversations. And then as soon as we were done, I did the in-person rollout, and we did a blended learning approach. Mm-hmm. So I was able to assign the courses as pre and post work. And then we spent the in-person training really deep diving into practicing and shifting behavior. And the employees loved it. You know, we really had great responses from the employees, and it was a lot of fun.
What did you take away from that process personally? Because it's a big ask, right? Or were you just the type of person that loved that kind of new challenge? Because I can't imagine every leader in your position would be happy about going out there and putting themselves out there, right? A lot of people were scared of putting themselves out there and putting them, you know, what people are going to say, you know, what's the feedback going to be, you know. And because I think there's a role now where many leaders and HR leaders out there are now becoming the brand of the business, and it's now almost expected. If you can look at LinkedIn as a perfect example, right? They did the same thing with their HR team, recorded many of these online presentations and workshops, the big conference that they do internally. So just wondering what you took away from it.
Well, for people who know me, I've always loved teaching others. Like I light up when I'm in a room and I'm helping people. It's always been something, it's been a golden thread, not only through my career, but through my life. So for me, I think the difficult transition for me was to think about the nameless people out there. My audience was people I wasn't seeing and meeting in real time, but that I would be touching in an expanded way. And so I just had to think a little bit about, oh, I can't use the reactions in the room to give me feedback. So I need I need to craft my message a little more carefully. Cause when I present live, I definitely have a plan and I have everything I've planned out, but I also use the reaction I'm getting in the room to make adjustments as I go. Well, with a recorded course, that's not there. You have to. So I had to do, it was great. It was an awesome learning experience for me. And the team at Lynda was phenomenal. I'm so grateful to their directors and producers because I had a big learning curve. Mm-hmm. The biggest thing was when you're used to being on stage or being in the light of audience, you now have to stand perfectly still. You can't even shift your weight because that moves you in the frame of the camera.
I know how that works, by the way.
Oh, yeah, you know.
I used to be a dancer, so you got to dance in that little square, Chris.
Yes.
You can't go out of focus.
So you have to stand perfectly still and then look at a piece of glass and act like you're having a conversation. And so I had to learn how to do that. And luckily I got great coaching and great feedback. And then I used some tricks. Like I would literally take pictures of people I knew around the camera.
Really?
So I had faces to look at. But it was when it got out in the world and I started realizing, I mean, I would get emails from people all over the world. I still do. I mean, every week I get amazing emails from people, and I just feel so grateful that technology allows us to touch people around the world and we get to hear from them. So it was nothing nothing but an awesome experience. And then, you know, I still went to work every day and I was still onboarding all the new employees. So I had plenty of interaction with the employees walking around the office, being in the cafe. So it wasn't like I was, you know, in solitude confinement or something. I was really happy when I got to then start teaching live in the company.
That's so amazing. Did you feel like, and I won't spend too much on this, but did you feel like people already kind of knew who you were and got to know you first through some of the training? Did you get that impression?
Because sometimes the employees. Yeah. So the employees who touched the production side of it did, for sure. So they would be editing my stuff or they were in the room with me when I was filming. But that was only one component of the business. Most of the other folks didn't, but I think my real self comes across in camera. Like, I have people who meet me that I've never met, but they have seen my stuff and they get who I am because I'm very authentic in what I say and believe. And I think that comes across on camera because I'm having a real conversation. So what's really fun is when I meet people who I've never met and yet we know each other on some level.
I know. I love that.
It's super cool.
Speaking to you now, and I literally just watched a few videos before our call, it's exactly the same. And I love that. And does not that you can't say that about everyone. So,
thanks. Well, I this is me without professional hair and makeup. So,
Lighting, professional camera. But this is the real you. And obviously, you know, the authentic, right? And you're exactly the same on camera as well. So it's amazing. Would you recommend other HR leaders record some of their training for their business, just out of curiosity? Do you think that's something that you would that would be helpful?
You know, it just depends on what your goals are, right? I mean, some people are very uncomfortable being on camera, and I certainly saw this with other authors. You know, a lot of people that come in to do a test course for Lynda never made it to the library because they couldn't come across as warm and authentic, and that was something that really mattered to Lynda herself. She wanted everyone to feel like they were having a cup of coffee with this thought leader who happened to, you know, just have some tips for them. So I would say it just depends on your career goals. I mean, for some of you, you know, it would really maybe help expand your brand or help people in the business see what you have to offer or how you can help support the business. But if for you it's incredibly painful and uncomfortable, then that's going to come across and that's not going to necessarily help. In addition, it just depends on what you have to share. I think, you know, we're drowning in a sea of information, right? The information age has taken off and there is no shortage of finding material available. That doesn't mean we have a whole lot of wisdom. And so I think, you know, just to record something may not be the best use of your time. You got to think about what's your unique contribution and what would you be adding to the conversation or what different take could you share that the world needs to know about. So I think when you have that and you feel compelled to do it, yeah, go for it. The actual mechanics of it, in fact, Chris and I were talking about this before we hit the record button, you know, it's just the tricks and tips you learn. Hello, tongue-tied. You know, eventually gets really demystified. Like at first you're really nervous and, oh my gosh, how do I do this? But, you know, people edit stuff on the backside and you learn a lot about, you know, the right microphone to use and how to frame your face and all of that stuff. I was teasing Chris because I didn't realize that I would actually be on camera today. So like I have no makeup on other than lipstick and I did not zhuzh the background at all. So if I had a little more warning, this would look a little better over here. But it's actually more simple than you think. And you can hire someone who has some experience to help you. And it's, I don't know, it's pretty accessible now with the technology we have. Yeah. So don't let the I don't know how to do it get in the way. You can easily get some support with that.
Yeah, we have our mobile phones, right? We have a mobile phone with a 4K camera in most cases now, high quality, high speed internet. There's no excuses. So moving forward, Britt, where we are right now, what are you most obsessed with right now? What's the main focus for you?
You know, for me, and it's not really right now, it's always this, which is I really think about how much our biology dictates how we move in the world, right? Our biology and particularly brain science shapes our thoughts, feelings, and actions for everything. And so I really look at that, and particularly I look about that in the work environment, because many of the problems we see in today's workplaces is because we're asking humans to go against their biology. And it never ends well. Like, it just doesn't end well. Biology is going to win every time. And
this episode of the HR Leaders Podcast was brought to you by our friends at Achievers. Two-thirds of employees have one foot out the door in 2024. And the top reason to job hunt? Better compensation. But money isn't everything. The Achievers 2024 Engagement and Retention Report reveals that employees crave emotional salary too. What does emotional salary mean? And what are the ways to increase emotional salary to engage and retain top talent? Learn more about motivating your employees beyond just pay by visiting achievers.com/HR leaders. Again, that's achievers.com/HR leaders. Let's get back to the episode.
So for me, when I started to get into neuroscience, it just added a level of aha that shifted everything for me. So to me now, it's like I just finished doing some research on the brain science of harassment and bias and like around the Me Too movement and Time's Up and all that. And even the brain science of what leads a harasser to engage in some of those behaviors. And the data is fascinating. And I just shared that with some senior executives in the media industry. And for me, like the minute I merge real world problems with what brain scientists are finding, there's always this amazing like, oh, if we can get this information into the hands of people who are living it day to day, this is really going to help. So that's always on my mind. And then what I'm focused on at the moment shifts based on what I see is trend, not trending, but I kind of look a little ahead and I see what am I seeing bubble up and what I know will become an issue soon. And I want to be a little bit ahead of that curve and have stuff ready when people realize they need it.
Yeah. Well, something which is very timely, which I've been following on LinkedIn is, you know, the biggest challenge for HR leaders right now is managing change. And it's shocking when you look at the numbers. And I know you've said this many times, when you think that 70% of change initiatives fail. When you think about that, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Billions of dollars every year.
Exactly. Could you talk about your Change Quest model, the science-based approach that you've developed for leading change? Because it honestly absolutely fascinated me, and I'd love to learn more about that.
Sure.
Share with the guys.
And this is where I have a few slides to share.
Oh, perfect.
So I'm going to share my screen. Let's see if I do this right. And now here, current slide. Can you see that okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So these are actually a few slides out of my content that I have on change. So this comes from the research that I did. And I started researching this, like I mentioned, because I was in the middle of a huge change and realized everything I was teaching other people was not working. So I thought, gosh, you know, and then that's when I came across some of the stats from Harvard Business Review about just how badly change initiatives fail. And this statistic's been true for decades. And yet we put a lot of time and energy. There's a lot of change models out there. There's no shortage of change books that you can buy. And I was like, why are we getting it wrong? You know, what's not working? And so, you know, for me, it's like, let's look at the neuroscience of things. And really all neuroscience is looking at the central nervous system. That's your brain and your spinal cord. And then the peripheral nervous system, that's everything else. And in this case, the lens was, how does that, you know, dictate how we move through change? And overwhelmingly, what our biology says is that, you know, we're prone to resist change. Yeah. It's part of our survival mechanism. And once I really understood what happens in the brain around change, I was like, oh, okay. So for me, it was really about shifting the focus. This is what most people think about when they start planning change, is they get really focused on what's the initiative, you know, what are the milestones, what's the budget. We create change plans, and it's really about we're going to execute the change plan. But most change fails over on this other side, which is the human side, which is the followers who have to go through the change, whatever change that is. There's a biological response to it, and people are emotional. They react to change. It's a process as they move through it, and eventually they adjust to it. And what I found was we spend all of our time on the left-hand column and very little time on the right-hand column, and yet the right-hand column is where all the breakdowns happen.
Yep.
So that's what I wanted to focus on. And this research that I did became my book, Wired to Resist. So if you want to read about it, you can pick up this book. There's both ebook and print book versions. But in the research of the brain science, I found some really fascinating things, and then it ultimately led to me creating the Change Quest model. Mm-hmm. So let me give you some highlights from the brain science part. I do, if you want to know more, I go into more depth, obviously, and share some of the studies, but this is the quick 101 on our brains on change. So the first is, you know, we all have an amygdala, and the amygdala is the part of your brain that drives the fight, flight, or freeze response. But the amygdala is connected to all the major nerves. So your optical nerve, your olfactory nerve, your auditory nerve, all of those connect. And what the amygdala basically does through our senses is every day it's scanning for your environment to make sure you're safe. So it's scanning, scanning, scanning. And what it uses to detect danger is a change. So change is what it's sensitized to. If there's a change in my environment, it could mean danger. And so the amygdala is particularly sensitive to change and sees change as a warning sign that danger might be there. And if you think about it, we are all, if you go back to kind of our hunter-gatherer days, we're all the descendants of people who had highly tuned amygdalas. They noticed the lion lurking behind the patch of grass and treated it with the respect it deserved, right? So over time, the amygdala can get activated a lot when change is announced. And if leaders don't know how to manage that appropriately, they can make it worse instead of better. The second brain structure is our basal ganglia. This is the part of our brain that takes things that we do over and over again and turns them into habits. It's the part of our brain that really creates behavior change. And if you think about most changes, they're not only asking people to do something new and different. Take, for example, asking the sales team to switch software or coming up with a new performance review system. People already had a habit around doing it the old way that was comfortable, and now you're asking them to do it a new way. And so understanding that you're not only asking people to develop something new, but you're asking them simultaneously to leave something that was comfortable and somewhat safe because they knew how to do it. And most change initiatives don't spend enough time giving people the training they need to shift those behaviors. We just kind of throw them out there, and of course, they start making mistakes. The third brain structure is the entorhinal cortex, and this is a really interesting one. It's the part of our brain that creates a mental map of our physical space. It's kind of how you know how to get back to the grocery store you like, or mm-hmm. back in our hunter-gatherer days, how to find the water source again. It's that part of the brain, but it also tracks social networks. So when you walk into a group of people, this is the part of the brain that's kind of reading who's got power in the room, who do you feel connected to or safe with. It builds kind of a social mental map for you. Well, some changes, if it changes your physical space or it changes the people you work with, it erases what the entorhinal cortex has built, and therefore this part of the brain may have to do some heavy lifting through the change. And then finally, there's the habenula. And the habenula is the part of our brain that tracks failure to make sure we don't mess up again in the future. So when we fail, it cuts off serotonin and dopamine, giving us a feel-bad feeling. And it's funny because when researchers want to study the habenula, they put people through a performance review, which really? I think is really fascinating. So even if like 90% of the thing you're getting good news, like the brain focuses on the bad news and kind of gives you this chemical hit of feeling bad in trying to keep you from doing it again. Well, what happens with change is that change, you know, I ask the room all the time whenever I'm giving this talk, I'm like, raise your hand if your change initiatives ended on time and on budget. And no hand ever is raised.
Well, there isn't ever a time as well, really. You can't put a time on change.
Right, well, exactly. And now also change mushes together. So you're barely finished one before you're into the next one. But what ends up happening is, you know, employees may have done great work to whatever shift they had already made. And instead of celebrating or recognizing or rewarding that, it's like, well, yeah, but we're late, or gosh, we made a mistake. So the brain is constantly coding change as basically failure. And then we wonder why people get more and more resistant to the next change that's announced. And all of these things are biological, but how, if you understand it, you can lead and manage them differently based on what the brain is doing. And, you know, many of us have seen the change curve. This is Kubler-Ross's classic change curve, but I flipped it upside down. But, you know, the studies show that, you know, we have all these kind of negative emotions at the beginning. And that's because at the beginning, our brain is focused on what we're going to lose, what could potentially go wrong.
Yeah.
That's not people being difficult. That's people being human. And I think when I talk to leaders about what to expect, then they're not so shocked. But many leaders are frustrated when they see these reactions and they don't realize that it's just natural and normal. And then there's some things you can do to help it. Once you get over that peak of resignation, and the peak of resignation means you either quit, you resigned, or you got on board, you resigned yourself for the change happening, or the leaders freaked out and pulled the change. So there's three types of resignation that can happen. Then people can start to look toward the future. And then that's when you start to get these more positive emotions. And the reason I flipped the curve upside down, it used to go down into a trough and then back up, is that I know for myself, when I was in the middle of that acquisition, the first part of change feels like you're going up a hill. It feels like this. It Yep. feels like, oh God, you know, I don't know if I can do this. And how far away is that top? And you know, you get tired and you get grumpy. And I realized at that point that I kind of had the metaphor I wanted to use for the model itself, which was really, if we think about it, change can be like mountain climbing. And after I wrote the book, I got awesome emails from people. This one woman sent me a photo of like all the parts she dog-eared, and I got lots of invitations to come and do the talk in organizations, and that was awesome. And then very quickly came conversations like, can I get certified in this? Can we buy this so we can roll it out in our organization? And so I've spent some time making that available to people. And that's the Change Quest learning solution. But I want to give you a couple more highlights about the model itself now that we understand the brain science.
Fantastic.
So one part of the model is to think about that not all changes are created equal. Like a merger or acquisition is like the upper right-hand corner, a big, you know, hike up a very crazy mountain. But some change, like if you change the faucet in the bathroom, maybe it's like the lower left corner, like no one's even going to notice it. It's not even a big deal. So I came up with this idea that basically based on how long the change is going to take to roll out and how disruptive it's going to be to the status quo for those employees, that becomes kind of a measure of resistance. We can kind of think about four types of change journeys. The big ones, the ones that take a long time and are a lot of change, a lot of disruption, are, I call them long and intense climbs, and they're going to be like that snowy mountain we just saw. Then sometimes we ask people to do a lot of change in a compressed period of time. So that's really asking them to do a steep sprint and really a heavy lift quickly. Now you get to the peak of resignation faster and you come down the other side, but you also burn people out getting up that hill. Like you're going to see more exacerbated stress. Then there's some change that is not very disruptive, but it takes a long time to unfold. So, you know, like if your org has to adhere to a new regulation that goes into effect 2 years from now, that would be an example.
GDPR.
And then, yeah, exactly. And then finally, there's the little stuff. It's hardly disruptive and it hardly takes any time. And that's kind of the pebble on the trail. And so one of the things I actually ask people to do in the learning solution, it's one of the activities, is I tell them to map change. Like, what's on your plate? When does it start? When is it supposed to end? How disruptive do you think it's going to be? And then I also ask people to add rhythm of the business, because look at the orange one in the middle. Like, people are going to be at the peak of resignation when the engagement survey rolls out. Well, you better plan for a lot of pretty bitter complaints on the engagement survey and to see a dip in your scores, or you should rethink the timing, right? The other thing you can do is start to identify where people are carrying too much change. So if you look at Q4, mm-hmm. they're in the middle of a big red hike. They've got two gold things overlapping. And you know what? Those pebbles on the path might now be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Like, they're not so small. And so when I ask orgs to do this, one of the things that happens is that people start to get an accurate picture of what they're asking of people. But in addition, they can start to identify the potential hotspots and make different choices. And it also forces parts of the business to talk to each other, because facilities rolls out change and they've got all these great plans, and then HR is rolling out our changes and we've got great plans and IT is doing something. And I think every org needs kind of an air traffic controller where someone is paying attention to, well, what are we asking our people to go through? Because when you start to map how many changes they're asked to go through, you realize, oh, well, no wonder they're exhausted.
Yeah.
And then another part of the model is this idea about motivation for change, right? And it, you can make, map it on this matrix of, did people get to choose the change and did they want the change? So the upper right-hand corner is going to be things like, I apply for a new job. And yes, that's going to be hugely disruptive to my life, but it's change I want and it's change I went after. So I'm going to have a lot of energy for it. I'm going to have a positive attitude about it. If you look at the upper left-hand corner, that's like the LinkedIn acquisition of Lynda. I was excited about it. I always wanted to work for LinkedIn, but I didn't choose it. And so I'm going to embrace this opportunity, but I'm not quite ready for it. And I wouldn't have taken on such a big change in my life at that moment if I'd had a choice, but here it is. So let's go for it. Then the purple, you know, we do this to employees more than we realize, but we roll out a lot of changes where they didn't choose it, nor did they want it. And this is just kind of the biological reaction we have, is that we're going to resist it. We're going to dig in our heels about it. There's going to be all this stuff that the amygdala and all those parts of the brain do to kind of make people grumpy. And then finally, there's this weird category, which is, I don't want it, but I'm choosing it. And these are usually where, okay, I'll take this, you know, I'll relocate because it'll set me up for a better job in the future, or I'll do this because it's for the good of the team. You know, you've chosen it, but you don't have a great attitude. So you're not bringing a lot of forward energy to it. And so then you can start to say, okay, of the changes we're asking people to go through, what are their attitudes about it? And this gives you great insights about what skills your managers and leaders need to have to get their people through it. That orange hill, you've got a bunch of treasures, and it's going to culminate in the engagement survey. That's going to be a big mess if you don't do something differently and make sure that your managers are really skilled at dealing with resistant people on a difficult climb. So that's kind of two of the key elements. And then the third key element, and also change fatigue. One of the things I like to talk to people about is it's a real thing now. You know, almost half of executives believe it's a problem in their organization. And the symptoms of change fatigue are, you know, you do see your engagement scores go down. People start taking more sick days and you know, they're just not in as often. People get confused. You see poor decision making. You also see more conflict between teams and on teams. And then people get cynical, particularly if they've been through some change initiatives in the past and either they failed, so they put all this energy in and it didn't work, or they just were never given time to recover before more was asked of them. And so I like to help there's four groups of people involved with change. And this is kind of the last component of the model, which is really making sure everyone knows what role they play. So expedition designers are your senior leaders. They're the ones who usually are looking ahead to the future of the organization and decide that change is needed, and even probably put out the broad brushstrokes of that. And that can be great changes like, hey, we're going to expand into the China market. Well, that's a big decision, right? Or, gosh, we're in trouble. We need to do a reduction in workforce. That's a big decision too. Then there's your trailblazers. HR leaders are part of this group, as are IT and other folks. There's usually some part of the business that has to go ahead on the trail and set up the change before everybody else goes through it. So like if you're doing a change in your performance review system, there's a lot of work that the HR team does to get that all set up before you ever tell the rest of the employees about it. So trailblazers run the trail a few times because they have a role in setting things up. Your guides are your managers, or you know, they're supervisors. So they've got direct reports that they're responsible for taking through the change, whatever change that is. And then finally, there's the travelers. These are the employees. Sometimes it's your customers or clients, but it's the people you're asking to take through change. So those are kind of the core components of the model. And then I give everybody, once everyone understands the brain science and kind of like these core elements, then I give people specific tools and strategies based on which hat they wear. So there's content for employees, there's content for managers, and there's content for senior leaders.
Fantastic.
That's the Change Quest model in a nutshell.
Well, thank you very much. I love the simplicity of it. And I also love the visual that you provided to be able to see the journey. I think this is very, very important, because as soon as you can do that, you can start identifying those blockages, right? And you can predict and prepare. You can prepare the training, you can prepare, you know, whereas at the moment we're just reacting.
Exactly.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I see. We're waiting until we have these problems rather than predicting it and forecasting that. Well, look, we know during the performance review we're going through this dramatic change. There are going to be problems, guys. Let's prepare for it as well. So I think that's the key takeaway for me personally, what I've seen as well. What has the reaction been from the HR community that you've shared this with?
Well, several orgs are using this already, and the reaction has been awesome. So everything from, this just changed the conversation. Like, all of a sudden, after the very first session, everyone had a shared language. I heard my leaders start talking about what kind of change are we asking people to go through and how motivated are they? It just creates awareness at kind of like all levels of the org. So folks have said they love it, because I've already baked into it kind of how people learn about it. So it already has the aha moments, all the exercises are built into it, everything. So it's driving shared language and an immediate kind of metaphor that everyone gets. So no matter what culture you're in and whether you've ever mountain climbed or hiked before, you kind of get it. And we know that the brain thinks in pictures, not words. So using that visual storytelling just creates an understanding. The biggest aha moment that everyone walks away with is the brain science part. Because when people are hearing it, they instantly go, oh, so that's what happened. And that's true from the senior executive CEO to a brand new hire at the lowest level position. Everyone can see themselves in it. And so then they're really motivated to use the tool. So it's really driving amazing behavior change. Mm-hmm. So it's been really well received, and for me, it's all about getting the tools out in the hands. I can't get to every org, and I just want my tribe to have all these tools so that they can help their people. So mm-hmm. I'm super excited that folks are using it, and I just get lots of great feedback on it.
So what are some practical things we can do now we understand brain science? What are some practical things we can do to engage our employees through change now we know this?
Right. So some of the things are, you know, and I do it kind of brain structure by brain structure. So if people start to understand, like, oh, the brain sees change as a potential threat, then we have to really be clear in our communication up front, like, what are we going to gain? How is this going to solve things? What will this make better? A lot of leaders have awesome visions, but they're not great at sharing those visions. And so it really helps them see how they need to craft that message a little bit. It also really helps managers and leaders understand that there is some grumbling. It does not go away. It's there. You can lessen how long it takes, and you can lessen how dramatic it is, but you never make it go away. So I think it also helps managers and leaders just have better empathy and better emotional intelligence with leading folks. And we even talk about like creating psychological safety and how important that is, but we don't just talk about it as a concept. We actually teach people how to create it, and they practice it. Certainly, like, I worked with one organization that was doing a lot of physical moves. They were combining teams, so they were changing their social networks and they were putting them into new buildings. And so we just talked about the importance of really front loading a lot of communications with physical maps and even, you know, camera walkthroughs of spaces. And then instead of doing org charts, actually doing people's faces, because our brain thinks in pictures. And so there's a lot you can do around just making sure you're scaffolding the change with additional resources that help kind of calm down the nervous system and make it easier for people to get on board. Mm-hmm. And then even when you're doing an awesome job, it's about having some patience with some of those difficult emotions, right? Yeah. You're not going to bypass that part, but you can get better at kind of helping people move through that part.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. I think the preparation part is what we're missing in this, and preparing our leaders for this change. And a big thing I've been hearing a lot recently is really helping your employees understand how it's going to impact them and preparing. Because that's the missing piece in most circumstances. Okay, I understand the business is going for change, but what does that mean for me? And unless you know that, that's when the fear skyrockets, right? When you don't know how's it going to affect me, then the worry kicks in, and the disengagement and the sick days, then everything you've kind of mentioned. Whereas if you can be, and it may not be a great message, but they still have to understand it. It may not, and that's what come try and hide that in some sense, being completely transparent and letting people know that this is in the best interest of the business. This is how it's going to affect you. People would rather have that than actually the unknown and the worry and the concern.
For sure. And there's two pieces of thing. Here's two pieces of information I like to share, and it's in the learning solution. One is that in the absence of information, the brain will create its own narrative. So a lot of leaders don't provide information. But when you don't provide information, what people will do is they'll create their own story, and it will be worst case scenario. Our biology wires us to plan for worst case scenario. And this is where leaders go, oh my gosh, Britt, we were, you know, working on a change initiative, and the next thing we know, everyone's panicking about a layoff. And that was nowhere in anything. And I'm like, yeah, but they went to worst case scenario, right? The minute they start whispering, if you're not driving the narrative, you've lost control of the narrative. So I think that's important for leaders to understand, is that I think they sometimes are like, oh, well, we don't want to start this conversation because they might not like what they hear, or we just don't want to reveal too much. And what they don't realize is they've now unleashed the beast.
Where would you rather be?
Yeah, right. So that's one thing. Yeah. And well, and then that, it was so funny because in the acquisition, I did that. Like, it was funny because I teach this stuff. I understand the brain, and my husband and I, you know, the acquisition had come through, and I was getting, there was great stuff happening for me. And yet still I was cycling through excitement to like these terrible worst case scenarios. Like, what if I go to the company and nobody likes me, and, you know, I can't do a good job. And I had taught the change curve before, and I would look at my husband and I'd go, I know I'm in the middle of the change curve, but I can't stop myself. And it was really interesting to see, even if I understood my biology,
that's fascinating,
how much it was still like, I couldn't sleep at night. I had a very real experience of how powerful that biology is.
But because you understood it, it was a lot easier.
Yes.
And that's what's really fascinating, that you're going through it and you're thinking about it as well at the same time. It's something you teach, something you talk about all the time, and you can identify that. So I think that's also something I've personally taken away from this conversation, that next time I'm going through these changes. A good example, I'm just about to be a dad. In 2 months' time, my life's going to change.
Yes, it is.
Very dramatically. And I'm sure I'm going to have some fear and some concern, but I will be thinking about what we've discussed today and actually processing that in my head. And that, I think that really will actually genuinely help.
Oh, good. Well, remember, when you're a new parent, not only are you, all your habits, so everything about how you live your life right now gets messed with. So your basal ganglia will be working overtime.
No more
but
sleep.
In addition, you have no sleep. Exactly. So you'll also be like sleep deprived. And so your ability to think rationally and logically is tested and strained. You'll be awesome. Being a parent is awesome.
Everyone says everyone says all the things you just said, and they go, but you'll be fine.
Well, I mean, I have to say parenting is just such a great leveler. Like, nothing increases your emotional intelligence and your empathy besides coming a parent. And so it will open up parts of yourself you'd never seen before, and you're going to love it. And it's also going to be hard. Like, sometimes it's hard raising a human, you know, there's this little being that depends on you. And that's a whole new way of thinking.
Well, look, Britt, that you've provided some amazing advice for everyone. And that leads us quite nicely onto our quick fire round. I'm going to ask you 5 questions, and you have no longer than 30 seconds to give us some amazing answers. Are you ready?
Is there like a great little soundtrack that, you know, counts down that, and makes me nervous?
Yeah, I should do that. I'm going to edit it over like a little countdown. What was the number one thing that was holding you back from becoming a senior leader within your field?
Well, nothing. I actually did become a senior leader in my field. So I kind of got to live the dream, and I'm still living the dream. So I don't think that anything held me back. I think the thing that I had to do was not wait for people to offer me opportunities, but I needed to be more proactive about seeking them out or even pitching them. I mean, I went to Linda Weinman and pitched that she needed a chief learning officer. And she was like, you're right, we do. But I was totally nervous to do that. But I thought, it's never going to happen if I don't at least propose it. So I think it's really about,
Taking charge.
Taking charge. Worst that happens is you get a no, but you're certainly not going to get a yes if you don't ask.
Yeah, it's an important piece of advice, guys. You know, you have to take charge. Don't wait for anyone else's permission to do it, which a lot of people do, both inside and outside organizations, guys.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received?
You know, there's two things that stand out to me. One is I read the book Essentialism. A friend gave it to me, and it's really about, like, you know, you can be, and I struggle with being fascinated with too many things. And so I can start to put my energy into too many directions, and then you don't get very far. And so it's really about honing in and committing fully to the thing that I'm most passionate about or most suited to bring change to. So that really helped me. And then the other one was Oprah. I remember seeing an interview with Oprah early on where she talked about retaining control of her intellectual ideas or her ideas. And that really shaped some of my choices around producing myself and publishing, where I just got clear around wanting to control more of the journey than handing it off to other people and not being able to keep it pure and true for what I was trying to create.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. And aside from your own, which we'll talk about later, what books would you recommend for our audience and why?
I'm glad you said aside from your own, because of course my first answer is going to be like, mine, they're awesome.
Of course, why not?
You know, two that I've read recently that I love are Dan Pink. He wrote Mindset and a whole bunch of ones, but he has a new one out called When. And it's all about the timing of things. And he has a lot of great brain science in there. And it honestly will change how HR thinks about how we build the workday. It's pretty mind-blowing. So I encourage you to pick up Dan Pink's When. And then Daniel Goleman, the father of emotional intelligence, and Richard Davidson, the big guy who's doing the brain science of mindfulness, wrote a book last year called Altered Traits. And the science of mindfulness and what it does to us as individuals and collectively healthcare and all that kind of stuff is really, really fascinating. I think every HR person should be figuring out how to bring mindfulness to their organization. It'll pay off tenfold in numerous ways. So those would be two of my, oh, and I'm going to add one more. Frederick Laloux wrote Reinventing Organizations, and his research on the conscious evolution of organizations is mind-blowing and changed how I think about how organizations are shifting in our world, and it's very timely right now. So I would pick up those three.
Fantastic. Could you share one internet resource that you use to keep up to date with current events, your own learning?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about internet resource, I mean, for me, it's calendaring. Like I have to be a master of my calendar, and I have to, the way I calendar myself is how I set my priorities and create boundaries. So learning how to really use your calendar feature is, I think, huge.
Use a particular resource, or is it just a standard?
You know, I'm on the Google suite of stuff,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I've really gotten good around, blocking time and dedicating time to when I'm best for certain activities. And it was interesting, Dan Pink's book, When, totally reinforced what I'd kind of discovered about myself. But it's really important. And also putting stuff, you know, personal stuff in there, like self-care or, you know, the things that matter to me, my family, those go on first. And then I really, you know, use LinkedIn as a way to stay up on kind of things that are happening in the industry or the fields. I also like ATD as a Association for Talent Development. And then, you know, I process the world's events through Trevor Noah and The Daily Show.
Nice.
I have to take some of the things happening in our world with a little bit of humor, because sometimes they can get overwhelmed.
A bit intense, yeah. I tend to avoid the news at all costs, if I'm honest. It's not what I want to wake up to in the morning.
Well,
a great way to start my day.
Yeah, absolutely. And the brain treats media as real. So
yeah, exactly. Because people don't realize that. As you said, they're seeing it, right?
So if your brain is, if your amygdala is activated every day by what's going bad and wrong, you can end up living a very high stressed, anxious life with stuff
you're causing
you don't
it
really
yourself,
need to.
Basically.
Yeah, you got to think about what you're giving access to your psyche. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. And what's one thing around running your own business, you know, right now that you're most excited about?
Well, you know, I didn't expect to create learning solutions. I thought I would just do research and write books, but it was when so many people kept saying, oh, can we get trained in this? Can we buy something from you? So I've launched this whole learning solution part of my business. It started last year, and I've got the change training out now. I'm going to have my my teams training, because my other book is on the brain science of peak teams. And then I'm also building a brain-based manager training that will be out in 2019. So it's really fun to work on that. It was completely kind of an unexpected part of my own business growth, but I really love doing it, and I love getting my tools out where people can use them.
So tell us about the new book then. It's out soon, right? I'm fascinated, by the way, that you do a book every single year, or even two this year. I don't know how you managed to get time to...
Oh, I did. I don't do two a year. I do one a year. But so my method is I research a topic, and then I premiere that topic at ATD. So ATD is the big international conference that happens every May. And then, so I do it better if I teach it first and then turn it into a book. Because when I teach people, I think about what are the aha moments and what do they need to know in what order to go on this journey with me. And if I sit down to write first, I get all stuffy and stiff, and I suck if I do that. So I teach it first, and then I take that and turn it into a book. So last year I presented the research on the brain science of teams, and that book, Wired to Connect, just came out in May. And it was really fascinating. It really talks about the brain science of inclusion and bias and creating psychological safety. It's very clear that there are certain prerequisites before any team can ever hit peak performance. And we want our teams to hit peak performance, but very often in the early stages of when that team is getting formed, we do not set them up for success. And once things go badly in those early stages, you almost can't recover. So, yeah.
Such an important topic. I think we need to do an entire another show on that topic, because
back. This would be fun.
For our workshop this on Tuesday in Geneva, biases was a huge topic. I probably had to stop everyone from talking. I think we spent over an hour and a half talking about bias. It's very, very important. Very important as well. So yeah. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. I'm really grateful that you joined us on the show. I feel like I've been stalking you for too long now, not telling you.
It's lovely to connect with you, Chris, and I love the work you're doing. So thank you for inviting me.
Thanks a lot. Well, look, Britt, before we part ways, tell our listeners, you know, there's one piece of parting guidance you can give to other HR leaders out there, or which are our audience. What would that be? And also, what's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and find out more about your work?
Great. So connect with me on LinkedIn. I also, for my followers, and people can subscribe to my quarterly e-newsletter. That's where I kind of push out some of my content, and I love to build my tribe even more. So please reach out to me on LinkedIn. And then I've got two websites, brittandriotta.com. That's kind of my thought leadership and speaking and books. And then now brittandriottatraining.com is where you can find my change solution if you want to get certified. In terms of parting piece of advice, I would just say people are capable of so much. Like, we all have untapped potential. And I would just encourage, I think what's challenging about HR is sometimes we work with kind of the problem children in the organization. We can get focused on the lowest common denominator performers, and really 80-90% of your organization is people with big hearts working hard, and they want to be seen and appreciated. They want to bring their strengths to your organization, and they want to grow to their fullest potential. And I think if you shift the focus to really cultivating the potential of your people in your organization, you're going to be blown away by the results. And it's going to make your work feel a lot more fun and satisfying. So start thinking about shining the light on potential, putting your energy into potential,
rather than just putting out fires.
Yes. Yes.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you so much, Britt, for providing such actionable advice for our listeners. I know they're going to be a lot better off for it, so thank you for that. Guys, head over to hrleaders.com. There you'll find the show notes on the episode, all of the resources that are mentioned, all of the links that Britt's mentioned will be included in the show notes for you guys, so don't worry about that. You don't have to write it all down. Apart from that, I wish you all the best until we next speak, Britt, and I look forward to reading the new book.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.